Не possibility in Ethiopia. So what I would like to do is some I would like to discuss about some recent work by many people, and at the end discuss some contribution we have in a senior paper with Antonello Scarticchio, Marcus Behnner, and Igor Clever. So what I talk about is basically the ABS-CFT and the computation of anomalous dimension in the conformal free theories. So typically we talk about n equal 4 super young Mills. And we will see that integrability will play a crucial role, and one thing we will compute is called CASP anomaly, and this is a quantity which is important also in QCD. So first we will discuss how anomalous dimension computation can be understood in terms of spin chain, and the typical spin chain is called the Heisenberg model, and this arises in the SU2 sector of n equal 4 super young Mills at one loop. And the technique is known by more than 70 years, and it's called the Bethe-ANSA. This Bethe-ANSA is a technique to study quantitatively integrable spin chains. So then we will see how we can generalize from the SU2 sector to the full n equal 4 super young Mills. And in the last year there has been a very important conjecture that is called for some quantity which is called dressing phase, and with using this quantity one is able to compute what is the CASP anomalous dimension, and this is given in terms of some integral equation.
What is the BES, BHF?
This is Beiser, Evans, Staudacher, and Beiser, Fernandez, and Lopez. I will describe a little bit of the history of the conjecture. As you certainly know, n equal 4 super young Mills is conjectured to be dual to type 2B superstring theory on the vector which is ABS5 times S5. So this is a very important conjecture, and the simplest one of the simplest consequences of this conjecture is that the scaling dimensions of gauge invariant operators on the gauge side should be exactly equal to the energy of string states on the S5 times S5. So the energy of the string state in general will depend on the state and will depend on lambda, where lambda is the top coupling, and this will be easy to compute if lambda is very big. On the other side, the scaling dimension will be, so let's say, easy to compute if lambda is much smaller than one. Lambda is very small. So this here one can apply perturbative computation. But for lambda around 1, there is no technique, computational technique. So typically when I think about a gauge invariant operator, it's something like the trace of a product of some gauge, some fields. It can be scalar fields, can be ferrules, derivatives, and so on. On the string side, we will think about, typically will be, this energy will be very weak. And so typically we will have a classical string configuration, like this is supposed to represent a folded string, which is moving, spinning around. And so when one has this classical string configuration, one can compute the classical energy, and then one can also compute perturbatively in the string sigma model, one loop, or maybe higher loop corrections. One thing is that we will always be in the planar plane. So when lambda will be g squared young Mills times n is the top cap. This will be our parameter. So one way to rephrase, if you want, the computations of anomalous dimensions is in terms of spin chain. So typically, suppose we consider the simplest operators we can consider are like traces of products of two scalar fields. So this x and y are two adjoint fields for n equal 4 real Mills, and in general we can consider traces of these products. So this operator in general will have some non-zero anomalous dimension, and in order to compute it, one should do Feynman diagrams. So this would be an example of Feynman diagrams, and this will be interaction, a quark interaction that arises in n equal 4 super young Mills. Another way to rephrase this computation, this at least at the perturbative level, is to consider a quantum mechanical model. So one takes associate if we have an operator of this length A, we can consider a spin chain of length A. So this means spin chain is simply the tensor product of many spins. So in this case, we have two possible spins. So this will be like the spin for SU2, spin 1/2. So there will be two states, can be up and down. So for instance, we can say that the field X is a spin up and the field Y is spin down. So this will be an SU2 spin chain, and the length will be the length of the operator. So this is just a prime. So it turns out that in order to put the anomalous dimension will be the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. So we have to find what is the correct Hamiltonian corresponding to the anomalous dimension, which is corresponding to the dilatation operator of any force kinetics. And in order to do this, we can do Feynman divergence computation. So at one loop, the Hamiltonian turns out to be proportional to lambda, because it's one loop, and then will be sum over all sides of one of the an operator which depends on two sides. So this operator is acting on two sides, and it is 1 minus the exchange. So if it acts on xx, then gives 0. If it acts on xy, it gives xy minus yx, for instance. And this is precisely the Heisenberg model that was constructed in the 20s, and this is supposed to describe magnetism in condensed matter. And then you can go on, for instance, to two loops. So two loops, this is an example of a two-loop interaction. So there are here two lambda insertions. And the two-loop interaction will be something proportional to lambda squared, and then it will be sum over all sides of an operator which is not acting just, so this I didn't write down with the indices, but the main point is that this operator is acting on two indices, on three different sides. So it's the length of this interaction is bigger. It's not like length 2 at one loop becomes length 3. And then at order lambda cube, we will have an interaction of length 4. Okay, so this is, if we can, like for instance, from Feynman diagrams, one can compute some Hamiltonian, and then one has to just to diagonalize the Hamiltonian for the set of operators one is interested in. Okay, so basically you should think about all this. So here there are 8 dots. You should think about these 8 dots in something like. So if I draw a diagram like this, then this seems a 3 level, but you should think about the diagram really like this. So here we have a one loop interaction. So this is like the operator. So this will be the operator xx, let's say, computed in the position v1. This will be the operator xx computed in the position v2. This will be v2 and v1. And then you have to integrate over this position when you do the final diagram. So suppose we have like a more complicated spin like this. Then this will be something like. So it's really, you see, if you count the loops, it's going on.
Okay.
Okay, so we want to compute, so the problem is reduced to compute the spectrum of this spin chain. So we want to find all the states and the energy of these states. So let's look at, first of all, at the Heisenberg model, which is the simplest one. Which is the one where the Hamiltonian is just a nearest neighbor interaction, is one of the states. So first of all, the ground state, so the state of minimal energy is just when all the spins are up. This is doesn't have any as energy equal to zero, because the Hamiltonian is at one minus the exchange. If you exchange something which is the same thing, gives zero. Okay, so this is the ground state. We want to find the first excitation. So in order to find the first excitation, you put all the spins up, but you put one spin down. And then you consider state where this spin is moving in the spin chain. This downspin, which is like an impurity, is called magnon. is moving on the speed chain with some definite momentum t. If you use like the Schrödinger equation for the using the explicit form of the Hamiltonian, one can compute the energy of this excitation, and the energy turns out to be sin square of p divided by 2. Where p, okay, here we are considering infinite, we are considering spin chain, but we can, we should, when we think about the SFT, we should always think about the spin chain to be closed. So if it is closed, then the momentum is it can be from 0 to pi. Now one can go on, so this is like a quite a simple computation to do. Then one can do the two magnon state. So for the two magnon, one can consider a wave function where the general state will be a superposition of states with two down spins, which will be in position x1 and x2. And there will be some phase, some wave function psi. And we can do an answer for the wave function, which is two incoming, which is just a plane waves, but we have a possible interaction between the two magnons. So basically, there are two plane waves, and but the two magnons can exchange their momentum. And this is like a one-dimensional scattering. So there will be an S matrix, which is a scalar, which is just a number, and depends on the two momenta, p1 and p2. So one can, using the Hamiltonian, do a computation, and then one can find an explicit form for this S matrix. So up to now, using just Hamiltonian and doing some explicit computation, one can, like 5 minutes, compute what is the energy of a single magnon state, and then one can find the scattering matrix between two magnons on this spin chain. And the energy of the two magnon state will be just the sum of the energies of the, so will be sin square of p1 divided by 2 plus sin square of p2 divided by 2. So this is a very important part. It's, so this is called typical dispersion relation, the energy of the dependence on p, and this is called the S matrix. Now we would like to consider a generic state, so with many marks, etc. So the main point, now I will not prove this is not simple. The main point of the beta answer is that if you understand how the single magnon state and the two magnon states behave, then you can understand also the multi-magnon state. So the basic idea is that, and this is not always true, it's true only if the Hamiltonian is integrable. If you want, this is a definition of integrability. At least this is a working definition, which is good for us. So if the Hamiltonian is integrable, then the scattering of many magnon factorizes in the 2x2 scattering. So basically, if you know the S matrix for the 2x2 scattering, then you can construct the 3x3 scattering, and so on. So the energy of the, let's say, a 4 magnon state will be just the sum of 4 energy for every single magnon. So what remains to do is to find what are the allowed momenta. One cannot put arbitrary momenta. So the basic idea, this is this is due to Bethe, is to write some equation which has this form. These are called Bethe equation, where basically this equation arises from a requirement. One takes all the one impurities and passes it through all the other ones, and then imposes that at the end all the scattering, and so one has done a lot of scattering. So basically, for n impurities, one has done n minus one scattering, and then one imposes that it goes back to the original thing. This can be done for every single impurity, so we have like m equations, one for every moment. So this is just like an algebraic equation, if you want, or in any case, it's not a differential equation, just a simple equation. One doesn't have to do Feynman diagrams or so. If one knows so the S matrices, then and the dispersion relation, then in a sense the problem is solved, if you know which is that Hamiltonian is integrable.
So this equation determines p's, and then this equation determines momenta,
yeah,
and then there's dispersion relation that gives you energy.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have basically we have the m momenta with the m equations. So this is a lot of step. I mean, if you want to compute like this technique can be applied to many sectors in n equal 4 supremes. Actually, the full n equal 4 supremes is integrable. at least this was proven at one or two loops. And so instead of computing a lot of Feynman diagrams, if one is able to find what is the Hamiltonian, then from Hamiltonian one is able to find what is the expression relation and what is the S matrix, then in a sense the problem is solved. Then one has to study a much simpler problem, which is this set of equations. And the crucial part of this is the integrable, the fact that any performance of Pellian Mills dilatation operator gives an integrable automatic. So let's see how it will look for generic for the full and for force Pellian Mills. So the spin chain we were looking at before was SU2 symmetric. So every site can be spin up or spin down. Now for any quad force Pellian Mills, it's more complicated. So typically the full symmetry of the problem is PSU2/4. So it's a big supergroup. And the excitations will be, and there will be many kinds of excitation. And there will be 8 bosonic and 8 fermionic excitations. So one way, this can be seen also from the, this can be seen, for instance, from the gauge point of view. So the ground state will be something like trace of Z to the J. And the excitation will be like the bosonic excitation, there will be x, y, x bar, y bar, where x, y, and z are the x, y, and z are the scalar fields in any quad force Pellian Mills. Or there can be the 4 derivatives, the mu. This gives eight bosonic excitation. And also there will be the fermions, will give another 8. From the point of view of string theory, one can also see this. Basically, from the point of view of string theory, this state corresponds to a point-like string which is moving along an equator in a spiral. So there will be, when one goes in the Lightcone gauge, there will be 8 transverse excitations, which are bosonic. And this corresponds, there will be 4 of them will be in a spiral, and 4 of them will be in a D-spiral. So this corresponds, these are the 8 bosonic excitations. And also there will be fermionic excitation. So one would like to understand, in this case, what is the Hamiltonian, what is the dispersion relation, what is the S matrix, and see if this full model is integrable. Now the question is for any lambda. We don't want to study. So for one loop or two loops, this was proved. But what we would like to understand is for any lambda. Of course, we don't have proofs over there, so there will be various conjectures. But first of all, one can try to use this big symmetry loop. So this was done in full detail by Weisert at the end of 2005. So using the full this full symmetry group, he was able to prove that the dispersion relation is fixed. So basically, it's fixed just by symmetry. The dispersion relation is something like that. So it's, there is a square root, here there is a lambda, which is the top coupling, and then there is the sine square of p divided by 2. So, for instance, if we expand this expression for small lambda, then we get precisely what we had before. So, 4 lambda, c squared, p divided by 2. But this is supposed to be valid for every lambda. So, lambda can be whatever number. And p is also arbitrary. So, vp is always between 0 and 5. One crucial assumption is that now we are sticking to large operators. So, we are considering single trace operator, but they have to be very large.
Wait, so this is the dispersion relation for any scalar operator?
Yeah, for any excitation. So basically, this excitation is always the same because of symmetry.
Do you know for sure that it has to be a lambda factor there, but not, say, some other function of lambda that is linear?
From symmetry argument, you cannot say what is this function of lambda. But I think there is an argument due to Sant'Ambrogio and Zanon of 2002. I don't know if you, that were studying near, they were studying BMN states, and they were able to prove this formula, that instead of the sine square, you have just p square. But if you do exactly the same thing and you don't assume that p is small, you don't have to assume you get precisely this formula. So I think this combining these two evidences, they should prove that this is lambda for any. Of course, you can do perturbative computation. You see that at 3 loops, for sure, this is just lambda. And another check is that if you do the giant magnum states, then you will get precisely this formula. If you, yeah, large lambda. So it's true for sure small lambda, it's true for sure large lambda. If there is this argument at intermediate lambda. So I think this would be, one crucial thing is that we have large J. If you don't have large J, then this is wrong. This is another. This is for very high confidence level, we can believe, I think, this is Pearson relation. So the question is now, what is the S matrix? So there would be two questions. One is, what is the Hamiltonian? One is, what is the S matrix? Now, since we are a large J, we are not really able to say what is the Hamiltonian. Now we are trying to guess what is the dispersion relation, what is the S matrix, without knowing what is the Hamiltonian. So if you know the Hamiltonian, then we can compute the dispersion relation and the S matrix also at finite J. This is a step beyond what is possible to do now. So the S matrix in principle is very complicated because it's a 2x2 scattering, so there are 16 excitations, so the S matrix is 256 times 256 matrix. But if you use this full PSU symmetry, then you see that the S matrix is completely fixed as this as a matrix, 256 and 256 matrix that you know exactly, so it will be some function of P1, P2, and G, except an overall scalar factor. This is called sigma, and it will depend on the two momenta and the lambda. And this is called, typically it's called dressing phase, and it's written in this way. So the symmetry is completely, assuming this large J limit, completely fix the dispersion relation and completely fix the S matrix, but from this dressing phase, which is a crucial ingredient. One requirement which can be put, which is beyond the symmetry, it's called the crossing symmetry, was discussed by Yannick 1 year ago. And also this is kind of the fact that it has to obey this crossing symmetry is kind of a conjecture, but it seems very reasonable. So during last year, when there were some very nice improvements in understanding this dressing. So first of all, we knew that at three loops, up to at one, two, and three loops, the dressing phase is different. But in classical strings, we knew that it is not zero. So this classical string would be large lambda. So now the formula gets quite complicated. One doesn't have to understand everything. So the main point is that this was known by a return of followers of Dac analyzing classical string. They were able to understand how the dressing phase was. This doesn't depend explicitly on lambda because this is a large lambda limit, this is a classical limit. And this is a sum of the products of this QR of P. And QR of P is a complicated function of G and P, and this is simply the eigen value of some higher conserved charge on the magnum. So for instance, Q2 is just the energy of the magnum, is what we saw before. Q3 is some kind of more complicated function.
What is the dressing phase?
We defined it before. Yeah, so when you have the S matrix, it's a big matrix, and you know everything but scalar factor in front of it. This is the scalar factor. E to the I theta is a scalar factor. This is a function of three values: P1, P2, and G. One would like to know what is this function. And in general, it's not constrained by symmetry. It's constrained by this crossing symmetry, which is like a particle-antiparticle transformation. So this typical integrable model with the relativistic invariance was used, but this model doesn't have relativistic invariance. So for instance, the dispersion relation, there is this sine square of P, so it's complicated. And so from 3 years was known that there was some dressing phase in classical strings. Then 1 year ago, Hernandez and Lopez were able to find the string one loop correction to this. This was a step. Then another step was made by Bayer, Hernandez, and Lopez that they were able to find the whole loop. They were able to find a conjecture for the whole loop in all strings loop dressing phase.
But related to this dispersion relation, It seemed to be a quadratic relation between E and sine B.
Yeah.
So can you make a transformation to replace sine B by some other?
No. It's
this hasn't been successful.
No. For instance, if you take one thing, if you take this was done actually in a paper of today. So that if you take some limit of this model, where it simplifies a little bit, then you see that if you take, so you were thinking about the sigma string theory sigma model. Take a limit, then you see that in this simplified limit, then if you allow some coupling to be dependent on the moment, not dependent on the momenta, then you get the relativistic invariant. But still, it's not a relativistic invariant. It's so there is some similarity with the relativistic invariant because of what you say. So E squared minus sine square of P is equal to some constant, which is a mass square. Mm-hmm. But it's not really a relativistic invariant. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, okay, the main point from here is that there were using crossing symmetry requirements, various people were able to put forward a conjecture for this dressing tape. So the way this conjecture works is like it's the sum of the products of this function times some the coefficients are dependent on G in this way. So basically, the way you should think about this expansion is like a Fourier expansion. So this is like QR, P1, QS, P2 are like E to the I B PX for, but this was the right way of doing the Fourier expansion for this D1 and D2 value. So this entangles the various dependence of D1 and D2, and then the remaining function of G. So Beisertel and Lopez were able to find the large G expansion of this function, CRS, but this large G expansion is only an asymptotic expansion. There is no finite radius of convergence, so it doesn't define the full function. But in particular, it's not possible knowing just the large G expansion to reconstruct what is the small G expansion, what is the small G behavior of this CRS. But then Beisertel and Staudacher, they were able to put forward a final conjecture. So this is the final conjecture. So this is a function of G, which is the integral or the product of some Bessel function. And it turns out that if you expand this CRS, then you get first order, you get a little for Staudacher, then you get the one that Lopez term, and then it seems to get some more terms that were conjectured here. So here, I mean, these conjectures were made basically using crossing symmetry, and also it's not clear what was driving their design. So the main test of this conjecture up to now is concerning this some quantity which is called the Kasparov. So now we change a little bit topic, then we go back to the S matrix. Okay. So if there are questions. Okay, so the Kasp anomaly is something that people were studying also in the 70s concerning the deep inelastic scattering, QCD. And for what concerns us, so basically we're studying an operator like this. So we have this some scalar field, like this x, y, and then we take derivatives of it, and we take trace of t, phi, b to the s, phi. And this operator is not BPS, we have some anomalous dimension. One interesting thing is that the anomalous dimension for large S, this is called large SP, is grows like logarithm of S. This is not typical. Typically, they grow like J, like S, not like the logarithm. There will be a contribution like S, a contribution like X to the zero. There we have logarithm. This was known from the early 70s, early works of the CD. And the Kasp anomalous dimension is this function. So there will be delta, will be a function of G and S. For large S, we grow like log S, and there will be a coefficient, which depends on G. And this function can be computed perturbatively. So for instance, here we have three loop results, so it will be hg squared, and there will be delta g to the 4, g to the 6. And remember, g squared is g and mean squared times n. So it will be lambda. So in, inside this g, there is already square root of n included.
Is this scheme dependent?
No, in any Colfoss superring, since it's conformally invariant, there is no scheme dependence for this function. If you go to QCD, then there might be scheme dependencies, also because there is no conformal. Mm-hmm. But here, all these anomalous dimensions are well defined.
And does it get non-perturbative contributions?
Well, here we are injecting the large NP. So non-perturbative contribution are suppressed. I don't know if it gets some non-perturbative contribution on finite n. But finite n seems to be more complicated. Mm-hmm. So it's true that there is still this log s, but this if you go to finite n in QCD, for instance, then you get many more terms.
I see. Mm-hmm. And this expansion was computed in the 70s?
No, three loops is already very complicated. So this was done, I think, 2-3 years ago. One, two loops, I think it was done for NVH theory, but I'm not sure. For sure, the first loop was computed in the 70s. Am I correct? So what is the dual string state of this? So this is an operator. There will be some dual string state. Since this operator becomes the energy of this operator, the delta of this operator is becoming very large, the dual string state will probably be a classical string configuration. It turns out that it is. This was found by Gauss and Kreber and Polyakov in 2002. And this corresponds to a folded string. So take a string which is like a segment, which is a folded string, which is rotated inside ABS5. Actually, it's rotating only in an ABS3 slice of ABS5. So, okay, one can, it's the computation for the classical energy, it's quite simple. So one has to consider this metric, and then the solution looks like this in the limiting with, so there will be the coordinate will be zero and theta, the coordinate of ABS3. And the limit in which S is very big, the solution looks just like this, and one can compute the energy. And one gets a logarithm of S. This is already a very non-trivial result, because one gets a logarithm of S, adds more coupling, and adds large coupling. And so Gauss-Kreber and Polyakov computed the coefficient in front of the logarithm of S, and turns out to be 4g. So this F of g, computed from gravity side, goes like 4g at large g. And then Frolov and Seitling computed the one loop correction to this result. And this turns out to be minus 3 log 2 divided by pi. And there is no dependence on g. Then there will be a two loop correction, which will be 1 over g. The three loop, which will be 1 over g squared. So up to now, the two loop correction hasn't been computed. There were papers concerned about this part.
What's the radius of convergence?
So for small g, it's 1/4. For large g, it's 0. Mm. For large g, there is an extension of singularity at infinity. And for small g, it's... I will talk about that. So there is this argument that the radius of convergence will be 0. But here we are doing the large n expansion. So you are expanding g square root of n. So then it becomes, in this value, it becomes finite. This is a typical behavior also for matrix model, I guess, large n matrix model. And instead for large g, there is an essential singularity. So basically, the idea is that this function, this CRS function that I mentioned before, all of them have a sense of singularity at infinity, and they have a finite radius of convergence, which is 1/4. And the same translates back to the Kasparov dimension. So I said what is this thing which I call CASP anomaly, and so this CASP anomaly is related to some operator which is part of I think it's a single trace operator of any call force operator. So if you use this better answer that I wrote down before, then we should be able using to find some equations. So this operator will be composed of many magnons. There will be some equation which describes which are the momenta of each magnon. And solving this equation will give us the energy, will give us this function f of g. So since we have an infinite, we are taking the limit in which s, the spin is going to infinity, the number of magnons is going to infinity as well. So we will have an infinite number of equations. This infinite number of equations translates into an equation for a function. And this equation will be some integral equation. Now, the steps are quite complicated, but so the idea is that one, first of all, defines this function, sigma hat of t and g. So this t is kind of a Fourier transform with respect to the moment, to the magnon moment. And this will have to define to satisfy some differential equation, some integral equation, sorry. And so you see that here we have a sigma hat also here will be, there will be some kernels. And here is the definition of the kernels. They are given, they are complicated function of, they express in terms of Bessel function.
So where do you get this equation from?
So you write down the beta answer for so you write down the beta equation for the, so this is an SL2 sector. So this, the operator is phi ds phi, which is in an SL2 sector of any call force superior means. There will be, you know, the S matrix, you plug in the phase factor and everything. And then you find an equation for the distribution of the beta roots. And then you take the large S limit. So this is called the thermodynamic limit. And then after working for a while, you see which are the pieces which survive, the pieces that you have forget, and then you get this complicated equation.
I see. So this integral equation is a continuous limit of an infinite sum?
Yes. Yeah, so basically you start, the beta answer was e to the e pl equal to a product of s matrix. So you take the logarithm, and so this becomes sum. And then you take the limit, and so this becomes an integral. And this is the integral which survives there. But there are some Fourier transforms in the middle, but this is the idea. Okay, so this equation is easy to solve perturbatively for small g. So for instance, if you want to compute the 12th loop contribution to the CASP anomaly dimension, assuming that all the conjectures that were made up to now are true, then it's something which is a bit simple. With mathematical, you can do it in 5 minutes. And you get something like this. So you get the terms that were there before, and then you get the term for the fourth loop, and then from the fifth loop, but you can do very easily 14th loop if you want. And so there is a prediction for the fourth loop contribution to the anomalous dimension of to the CASP anomaly. And amazingly, this for loop computation, which is extremely complicated, was done. There was a group, Bern, Sasson, Dixon, Kosover, Smirnov, that did this computation and find precise agreement with this result. And also this same result was found with a better accuracy a couple of months later from Cacciado, Strade, and Volo. So this is a very nice test that this all this conjectures I were discussing before are correct.
Why is it called CASP anomaly? Can you explain that?
No. It's because it's related to some energy of some Wilson loop in like also in QCD, which is like which
Wilson
has
now.
Yeah.
So Fg is arises as the contribution from the cusp.
Yeah, it's from this this angle there.
So, and this goes back to the 70s?
Yeah. This is related to parton scattering, so different anti-elastic scattering is the main contribution to some process of different anti-elastic scattering. And for instance, one can make a prediction for the next term, for the fifth loop. So as an aside, we can see this one funny feature of this expansion. The feature is the following: for every term g to the 2k, the coefficient which is multiplying this term is definite transcendental. So this is a principle which was found by Cotti Coca-Tiba a couple of years ago. So what do I mean by that transcendental? So we assign transcendentality to pi is transcendentality 1. So here in this expansion we have pi powers of pi, and we have this is a Riemann function, a delta function. So for instance, delta of 2 will be pi square divided by 6. So this will be like delta of 2, this will be like delta of 4, this will be like delta of 6 or delta 4 times delta 2. And we have a term like delta 3 square. And this is true. So every term, like this is a sum of functions which have the same transcendentality. And the more you go on, the bigger this this becomes, but they still they have the same, all of them they have the same transcendentality. And there is no, this is a new thing, it wasn't appreciated like, I think, 5 years ago. It's true that when you compute Feynman diagrams, you can always find like countings of factors of pi and so on. But this is like, we do a computation, at the end the result adds up to this transcendentality, constant transcendentality. And one important point is that if you take QCT or another gauge theory in n equal 4, then you will get, at one loop you will get basically the same thing, at two loop you will get a part which is zero transcendentality and the part which has two transcendentality. And the part which has transcendentality 2 is exactly equal to the one which is in n equal 4. So in n equal 4 basically is singling out the highest transcendentality part. But if you take a more generic gauge theory in four dimensions, you will have this part plus correction of lower transcendentality. Actually, this correction are not small, so it's not a good approximation, but it's a nice observation. And this is like just an observation that is also this. And this fact is true only for the scarce phenomenon. If you take a generic observable, this transcendentality will not work. So there are many things which are coming together. For instance, the paper by Weiser, Fred, and Sestadak was called transcendentality cross. So crossing symmetry together with the transcendentality observation was a very important input for this ADS-CFT result.
Now, Kotikov and Lipatov found it for this particular cusp anomaly?
Yeah, this cusp anomaly was always studied during the years. It was one of the most important. Of course, if you could ask if there are like other observables that are expressed by this universal feature, so I don't know if any of you answer this. So we did after the paper by Balder and Staudacher with Ben, Ferbano, Scardicchio is to try to see if to study this integral equation I brought down before, like at finite cap. It would be very nice to study analytically and understand what is like the anomalous dimension of g equal to n, for instance. And this is the first time, I think, when one can do a computation like this. But before, it was always like either one is computing some protected quantities, or is computing some perturbative things, or is computing string perturbative expansion. But now, for the first time, we have an equation which is valid for every g. So one can ask, for instance, what is the value of g equal to l? One can ask what is the analytic structure if you think about g. So g is this coupling constant, that's a complex variable. What is the analytic structure? Okay, so what we did is to study first numerically this this equation, because doing it analytically is quite complicated. So numerically, the idea was to expand this function, which is sigma of t, which depends, which is basically giving us the density of the Mannon moment, so it's telling us how many momentum there are with definite how many margins there are with definite momentum. The nice thing is to expand them in Bessel function, in terms of Bessel function. These are not orthogonal, but they are linear independent, so this expansion makes sense. And so this is translated in a matrix equation. This integral equation becomes a matrix equation for Sn of g. So instead of having an integral equation, you have a matrix equation. And now, the nice thing is that one can truncate this matrix, the size of the matrix, and solve it numerically. And this is a good approximation. This is the nice thing. So if you want to compute, for instance, f of g and g equal 10, you have to consider like matrices which are 20 by 20. If you consider matrices which are 20 by 20, you get a very, very good approximation. If you want g equal 20, then you have to be to go to bigger matrices.
Is there a clear order parameter in this case that tells you what's the error?
Sorry?
You're truncating and there is some error to this truncation. Can you estimate what is the error?
We can estimate the error at the end. What we need is to compute the large G expansion, and then there are the coefficients. So there one can compute the error. Because changing, one can see how much the change in the size. Mm-hmm. And so one then can reconstruct f of g. So f of g is like sigma f of 0. If you put t equal to 0 here, it's singular. The only important part is S1 of G. And the result is the following. So this function is not particularly nice looking, not particularly interesting. But this is what it is. So it goes like linearly, it goes like linear very, very early. So this is the linear term predicted by the gaps at Clebsch polyfold, this is 4G. Then it goes like G squared for small g, and the transition is pretty. At least for real G, this function is quite important. But one doing this numerical studies, one can compute what is the asymptotic for large G. So one gets that there is apart from one part in a million, it goes like 4G. This gets a Kalman polynomial. Then the constant term is like the C5 significant digits. And this is like the 3 log 2 divided by pi of all the cycling. And this matches very well. So, and then one can compute for 3 digits of the 2-loop part, which was not up to now, it's not being computed. So this is a prediction for a 2-loop string theory sigma model computation, which has been, now is there are people that are trying to do the computation, but it's very complicated.
So this was done by numerically solving the equation with this particular expansion.
Yeah, so basically you fix g equal 1 and you compute f of g. Then you fix g equal 2 and then you do this.
So there is some sort of a priori knowledge of this is the correct expansion.
Yeah, this is a very important point. So that maybe you're asking why you're expanding like g, 1 over g and not log g over g, for instance. Yeah, that's well, first of all, I mean, numerically, it would be very difficult to find log g over g. And it's not clear if one should get log g. This is an open question. One, there might be terms like log g divided by g. But in the phase, there are not. So when one is expanding the phase, this is like only, it's an asymptotic expansion, but there are not terms like log g over g. And so they should arise just for the Casanova. But it's not, up to now, it's not known if there are such terms or not. So if there are such terms, then maybe this result, this number can change. This should not. Because if there are terms like log g, there will be like log g over g. So this shouldn't be this product, product produces, but this might change. Analytically, there was a...
This is the loop call that, this is something that can change it in a dramatic way.
In principle, I would say it does, but since it's an asymptotic expansion, I mean, many things can happen. Since it's an asymptotic expansion, it's also, that's also why it's so difficult to compute this analytically. So now, a couple of months ago, Aldar, Bruno, Ben, Aed, and Kleban, they were able to do analytically this 4 zeta, but it's very complicated already to do the one loop computation.
Large G, so a large G, I suppose, can do an alpha prime extension to the Swarovski theory. So what would be a term, what would the term log G over G correspond to in that language? Is there, say, any physical reason to expect that there could be terms like that?
If you have some divergence, maybe. If you have some divergences, that do not cancel, maybe you get some logarithms, but it's not. So, but the alpha prime is like square root of lambda. So the so when you have this sigma model, you have something like this. So this is the Lagrangian. So this is so.
So L is starts as a kinetic term for scalar fields?
Yeah, it would be kinetic terms, vortex terms, many terms.
Does it have some square root, some kind of imperia?
Well, this depends. If you do, typically you have to take this folded string background, so this becomes a background for the computation, and then you have to gauge fix. So it depends on how you gauge fix. What that will be like some Navier Schwartz, typically they do this, some Navier Schwartz, but you have fermions, you have gauge fixing, and a lot of things.
Okay, continue on this. I mean, I thought you were trying to explain why would the terms like geology by studying the motion theory.
The only thing I can say, I think, is that if there are divergences, then you might get this logarithm. Like you have to put a cutoff, but I don't know. I don't know exactly.
So in two dimensions, you can get a logarithmic correction for a variable step. If you have a gauge, here it has only scalars.
Oh, there are fermions, there are some.
But not gauge fields. Yeah, so if you look at the variable step, one contribution to the variable step would give you a log of the variable step. I'm not aware of any log correction for scale up.
Yeah, this is, it's not the usual, it's a very complicated sigma model, so it might be that there are additional features.
Right, the intuition is based on flat space.
Okay, so another interesting thing one can get from the numerical study, which would be nice to get analytically, is the full analytic structure of this scaling dimension. So basically, this I think is a question which is important in general. If you have a function, if you can compute an observable for every value from the couple, then you can also think what happens if you put the coupling to be imaginary, or if it is complex. So this is not the only physical region is for G greater than zero and real. But in general, this function will have some analytic, will be analytic, so they will have some analytic structure. And it seems the analytic subset is quite complicated. It's not like just like a meromorphic function or whatever. So for the analytic subset for this function turns out to be something like that. So at infinity there is an extensive singularity, and there is a zero for g small, there is a radius for convergence which is 1/4. And from here, at the boundary of the radius of convergence, some square root branches are open. So you have a function like this. So it's not, there are not holes, but there are square roots.
How was this studied, this analytic structure?
Well, we did, we studied it numerically. So basically you can compute, you can go like on a, you can take a line and go up like here and compute like the imaginary part, and you see like for I 1/4, you see the imaginary part is like zero, and then goes like zero. It's not really zero because it's numerical, and we are not on the imaginary axis. If it was exactly on the imaginary axis, it would be like this. So the function is something like this, g square. So there will be terms like this, and this is good because this is the scaling, this is the scaling dimension of a single giant mark. But maybe if you put n is an integer, so if n equal 1, then we get the first cut starting from I 1/4. N is equal 2, then we get the second cut, and so on. And these are the bound state of giant margins. So it seems that if one considers the bound state of the giant margin region and so on, one can get an understanding, at least a qualitative understanding of what is the analytic structure. But we don't have a much better understanding of this. What it seems to be clear is that when you go to large G, then you get all this, there will be an infinite number of branches. So branch cuts accumulating there. It's not clear that they will always be like square roots. And so this, and this will be, will give the extensive singularity at infinity. So if, even if this function is pretty boring, if you just look at the, on the real axis, if you go out the real axis, then you get the
question. Can you say something about this, like analyzing the kernel? Typically, you can look at some information about the practice of convergence in evolution, you look at the kernel.
So basically, the kernel is the kernel is computed starting by this phase factor. And this phase factor contains these functions, CRS. So basically, the analytic structure comes from here. And if you compute the, for instance, the radius of convergence of this function also has a sensitive singularity at infinity and a defined radius of convergence, which is the I quarter, which is 1/4. So I think this is the reason. So basically, the kernel is, so if you want to look, the kernel is something like this, so contains integrals of k, where k is the sum of two parts, kn and kc. So kn is pretty simple, kc is much more complicated. So will be the convolution of k0 and k1. These things are a Bessel function, so they contain j1 and j0. But if you can expand this as a, more roughly speaking, something like the sum of 1 divided by p, p prime, jn of p prime, jn of p, something like this. And so you see there are the sum over n and n, and then you get a t divided by e to the t minus 1, which is precisely this structure. So that's why you get, basically inside the kernel you get this CRS of G. So if you want, you can write the kernel in a very similar way of this expansion. But then you will have a sum overall Bessel function, and then from here you get the ratio of convergence is 1/4, so it should be the same also for the full. I don't know if I don't think this is a proof. It's just the this is what one expects, and indeed, if one goes like numerically to see where what is the ratio of convergence, one precisely finds the same ratio of convergence. Okay, so summary.
Was there any attempt to do a Borel transform?
It's not Borel sum. Mm-hmm. The CRS are not Borel sum. Already there, so when you convolute them, then it's going to work.
Sorry, one more question. So, this integral equation, I forgot when we mentioned this, does it come from the Fletcher equation of any sort?
Comes from, so you start from. From the beta equations, so you have if you have k magnons, then you get so the beta equation are like this: e to the I pk l is equal to the product of s pk vi product in I different from k. So these are k. Suppose you have m magnons, then you have. So for our equation, for our problem, there are s magnons, where s is this number, ratio of phi to the s. So this will be s equations. For then you take the logarithm of this equation, so we get e to the k l is equal to the sum of the logarithm of s.
These are algebraic.
This is an algebraic equation. Then you take the limit s going to infinity, and so this becomes an integral.
Yeah, I mean, my question is more naive. I mean, typically, if there is an integral equation, there are some methods of solving it by converting it into
a differential equation.
I'm sure if these methods are sort of completely unique or whatever, I don't know, but sometimes it's easier to deal with the differential equation rather than.
Yeah, I don't, we were not able to convert it into an integral into a differential equation. We tried, but without maybe we don't know the power of the method that we should use.
Is this easy to transform an integral?
No, I think there's no complete boundary for the solution. There's also a question of boundary conditions and so on. Mm-hmm. But I know that in some cases it's very successful.
So you need to use some guesswork in order to.
I'm not sure. Maybe.
Typically, the integral equation is a global problem, so you care about the full function everywhere, and the differential equation is local. So if you know in a boundary, you can go on and on. So it's not. And so, small summary. We saw that in general, the spectrum of cases, we always saw n equal 4, but this is something which can be extended to some other Gauss theories, can be understood in terms of spin chains. So this spin chain can be integrable. If they are integrable, that's a very good thing, and one can use the Hassard equations. And a group of people have found what is a conjecture beta answer for an equal force frame, which has passed many non-trivial tests. And in particular, we focus on this Cass anomaly, which is an observable of the Gauss theory, and it's non-BPS that seems to have many interesting features. So let me finish with a couple of other questions. One would be to find additional evidence for the correctness of this isometric, so maybe find if it is wrong. And one thing which I think is interesting is to consider the analytic structure of anomalous dimension in general. This is a problem that might be, this should be interesting from a generical Gauss theory point of view. And there might be interesting theorems about that. And another open question is, so we know that this beta answer is only, this typically people they call this beta answer asymptotic because it's correct only if the operator is very big. And so it would be nice to see how the thing changes when you go to finite length. In particular, there should be some Hamiltonian, which should be correct for any length. It would be very nice to find this Hamiltonian. But I think I can stop here.
Any questions?
I have a question. What's the class of possible observables that you could think of? Here you concentrated on one function, just anomaly, but is there a larger class of...
I think the main reason to concentrate on that, apart from the fact that it was studied before, is that there is a disentangle. Typically, the energy depends. Suppose you have the spin of this thing. So this is a parameter that tells you what is the solution. Typically, the energy depends on the spin and the coupling in an intricate way. Here, you have the dependence on the spin is logarithm of s, so you just have a function, one variable, which is the coupling. But for instance, you could consider folded strings in S5 or rotating strings, various classical string configuration where you can compute the classical energy, you can do the beta answer because it's quite simple, and there will be some integral equation, and then try to do the same story, at least related to an equal force coordinates. In general, this integral equation in principle should give the result for every observable you would like, any single trace gauge invariant operator.
And what kind of lessons can you extract from this on a generic field theory format?
I don't know. My impression is that the only qualitative lesson up to now, I think, is that for real G, you have a behavior which seems to be constrained by monotonic behavior. So I think there should be theories that say the behavior should be monotonic along the real axis. Or something, and also if you have two observables, the difference between the energies should behave in a certain way. And maybe, I don't know, that what the analytic structure maybe is very similar to this also for other observables.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Okay, then let's take the speaker again.